Welcome back. This is Denver Frederick, and you're listening to The Business of Giving on News Talk Radio 710 WOR. And it's now my great pleasure to introduce my first guest for this evening, Alan Lux. For more than two decades, Alan has led major nonprofit institutions, receiving significant national and international recognition. He worked with the Alcoholism Council of New York, followed by the Institute for the Advancement of Health. In 1990, Alan became the executive director of Big Brothers Big Sisters of New York City, the oldest and largest mentoring organization. Recently, Alan established the Center for Nonprofit Leadership at Fordham University, the first center sponsored by both the Graduate School of Business and the Graduate School of Social Service. He is the author of four books, including You Are What You Drink and The Healing Power of Doing Good, and has received many honors, such as Crain's naming him the Nonprofit Leader of the Year and Big Brothers Big Sisters establishing the annual Alan Lux Award for Public Service. Alan, thanks so much for coming in this evening.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let me start with your current assignment before we get on to your, I think, remarkable and storied career. You are basically the director of the Center for Nonprofit Leadership at Fordham. This was your brainchild, and I'd be very interested in terms of what inspired it and what your goals and objectives of it were it for.
Most of the nonprofit agencies in the United States are small. About 75% have budgets below $500,000. This is the heart of help in the United States, help for the needy, help for the poor. And these are agencies which constantly have problems, fundraising problems, administration problems. They lose a grant. And over the years, been over more than 25 years in this field as an executive director, people would call me up. I would lecture to groups. And I realized these especially smaller agencies needed help. I went to Fordham. Mm-hmm. I had been an adjunct professor there for many years. And I said, spoke to the dean of the School of Social Service, spoke to the dean of the School of Business Administration, because nonprofit agencies, as the business of giving, mm-hmm. the business of philanthropy, as you know well, is a combination of both. You have to have that vision of trying to change the world. At the same time, you have to have the efficiency to do it correctly. And I said, we want to have a program. We want to have a program that doesn't cost much, $535. And we talked about it, and we said it's insane to do. We're going to have to ask everybody to work on the cheap, which is nothing new in the nonprofit world. And we did it. And we've now trained almost more than 160 agencies. And after they get trained by us, they get a mentor.
I know. That's fantastic.
Who is a present CEO of a major nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And they can talk to that person for any problems they have. And it's nice. We see agencies that have a person who's the head of a small Haitian agency that helps young girls. And she called me about a month ago, and she said, you've changed a life. Or you might, I shouldn't say you. The Fordham program mm-hmm. has changed the life of the girls in our program. And that's what nonprofit agencies are all about. So if we can become a catalyst to the grassroots agencies throughout this country and become a model for many other places, that's our goal.
Alan, you know, you've been an executive director of nonprofits for many a year. Do you think that there is a different skill set needed today in 2011, perhaps, as there were 10 or 20 years ago, or do you think it's pretty much the same?
I believe it's pretty much the same, but raising money, mm-hmm. of course, in a recession, is much harder. You have a small agency who doesn't have, and that executive director doesn't have a board of very wealthy people, or presidents of banks, or senior executives even at different companies. How does he or she raise that money? At the same time, getting pressure from the community, do more, mm-hmm. do more. And the board doesn't know much, so they're not helping that much. And they're telling the executive director, you do more. And the staff saying, pay us more.
Yeah.
So within that, you have the nonprofit field, which has been the same as always, but much, much harder to raise money now. Mm-hmm. And what with the Fordham Center for Nonprofit Leaders and our training program, what we want to do is not only give them the skills and knowledge, but we give them truly lifetime support. They can keep on calling any of the professors back. And it's not easy. It's not easy. It's, you know, it's one thing to teach. It's another thing to do.
Right.
But by giving them the constant support, I'm hoping that we're seeding a foundation of the smaller agencies, the heartland of agencies in New York City, that will be able to do the business of giving correctly.
Do you see a generational shift from some of the younger people who are going through this program, perhaps, than the generation that preceded him, in terms of their expectations of the nonprofit they work for, or the expectations of the delivery of services that they'll provide?
No, I'm seeing some good things and some bad things. It's all of life.
Sure.
The bad part for the nonprofit world is that as people get more and more worried about money, they don't turn to the traditional source of nonprofit leaders, or people who have been, whether they've been lawyers, social workers, a business background, but the people who've tried to change the world a little bit. But they're hiring now, understandably, fundraising professionals primarily.
Okay.
People who've had a business background, but have never been involved in the nonprofit world, who come with that mission to say, and that gleam in their eye to say, I'm going to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a big, big change. And I'm trying to, through the Fordham Center, we're trying to train leaders who have that gleam in their eyes.
Yeah.
I'm going to change the world, whether it's for health or housing or education or social service. I'm going to change the world. At the same time, I know the most efficient procedures. So there's a little bit less of a gleam in the eye, but there's less of a gleam in the eye of all Americans now.
Yeah, you're
right. let's be honest. We're tough, tough times.
Yeah.
So how those tough, tough times are going to get to nonprofit agencies, and it's our responsibility to meet those times.
You know, the only encouraging thing I would say in that light is that we have a number of people who've been on the show who have left major investment banks and McKinsey and Company type organizations to go to the nonprofit sector, because there does seem to be, at least recently, this new spark for social enterprise in terms of doing things differently and changing the world in terms of giving a sense of purpose. So I hope what you're doing up there is beginning to catch on, and many of the very best and brightest minds are beginning to choose this as a career and a profession.
Oh, I truly believe so. However, a study, I'm a visiting professor at Fordham also, so I teach in the Graduate School of Social Service. A study out of California of who heads mental health agencies. At one time, it was 80% of people who had that gleam in their eye who graduated from schools of social service or law, but right away had gone into helping.
Yeah.
Like I did. I practiced law at the after the Peace Corps in Georgetown in Harlem. Those people were 80% of running mental health agencies. They're now 20%, mm-hmm. and the other 80% are the business people. I'm not against, surely, because I'm training them. We're not against people who just have a business background.
Sure.
But they have no other background.
Yeah, they don't have the missionary zeal necessarily.
They don't have the missionary zeal. And that's what the charities are. We are the public's conscience.
Mm-hmm.
We are supposed to represent what people want to do. They don't have the time to do. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to do. By helping your fellow man. It's not just helping your own agency. It's helping the world. It's changing the world a little bit. And a lot of people may be embarrassed to say it. But unless you can say, I want to change the world a little bit, and that's why I'm in this field, it's part of my teaching, of course, you don't belong in this field.
Do you think the nonprofit sector has coalesced effectively enough in terms of them as an entity in a unified way speaking out to try to change the world?
No. It's one of my new causes, a difficult cause, and that is we live in a country now which is having a severe economic question. Where are we going to be?
Mm-hmm.
25 million unemployed. When I teach at the School of Social Service at Fordham, there's a big question. Are these kids going to be able to get jobs? I'm worried about I have two grown children. I have a grandson. Are they going to be able to get jobs? Are they going to be having health insurance? What about their Social Security? So you just can't say the next generation is going to have it. The whole idea, the way how I was brought up, is this generation has the responsibility.
Sure.
That means this generation of nonprofits have to stand up now and say, we need to do something.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't know what to do. How do we get the engine of the U.S. economy going again? But what we do know is that there are ideas out there from the economists. I don't have them. From other professionals. And so my cause has been to get nonprofit agencies to stand up individually,
mm-hmm.
and say, among the many challenges has been to, we would tax slightly. The first $500 of a donation wouldn't be tax deductible as it is now. This money could be used by government to try to stimulate employment. That we need to stimulate employment, and hopefully it would work. So far, it's been an uphill battle, very uphill. The most nonprofit agencies say in this terrible, terrible time, and understandably,
yeah.
we're not giving up any contributions.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we can give up some contributions, we could become a leader.
Mm-hmm.
We can become a leader to tell them, the banks and the financial service agencies and the manufacturers and the big corporations, come on, you also have to get aboard now.
Mm-hmm.
And start to cut back a little bit and start to say, we'll accept some change in the hope that this economy can become jump-started and then the people can have jobs again. Without jobs, we're going to have a terrible terrible society. And that's what the public wants us to do.
Sure.
People give us contributions. Why don't they give us contributions? They could just go out and give the contributions themselves. But they don't have the time to do it. They don't know where to do it. So we're the public's conscience. We're supposed to be doing what the public wants us to do. We're their conscience. We're supposed to be doing the good deeds.
Yeah.
Therefore, the big good deed right now is, how do you get unemployment reduced in this nation? Charities have to stand up and begin to accept some responsibility for doing this. We just can't think of ourselves.
Well, we've always been the moral conscience of the society, and I hear what you're saying is a wonderful opportunity for us to lead by example and really then speak to, because I tell you, we live in a world right now where nobody wants to give an inch. People are dug in, and I think they feel if they give an inch, they're going to get run over, and we see it with the Democrats and Republicans or whatever. People just don't want to give at all, and that will never lead to any kind of solution. And you just wonder how much more time we have to be able to be as stubborn as we are before somebody sets that example, and you think the nonprofits would be the right ones to do it.
Well, I think there's two groups, going back to my in the civil rights movement, which I'm part of, and my generation of the 60s and 70s, the groups that you counted on to provide moral leadership were religious groups, charitable groups, and universities. Now, with a poor economy, every group, except on the extreme end, has retrenched and saying, not me, not me, not me. That's just as you just said, Devin, that's correct. I know the charitable field. I know we have the potential. We have the people who have the gleam in their eye. So I do know that charitable agencies, don't forget, we honor corporate executives. They come to us. Corporate executives give us money.
Mm-hmm.
We're connected to them. We have a way that if we stood up and went out to our contributors, we went out to our board members, we went out to our communities, we do have a way. We're not such a movement that we don't have power in the United States. We do have power in the United States through our contributors, through our board members. We can do something, and through our communities, we can do something right and stand up and say, let's all work together. Let's all work together. Stop the polarization. Talk to each other. We're the charitable field. We're the moral conscience. And we're going to start it off.
Yeah.
We're going to start it off by accepting some slight minor change to the tax treatment of how contributions are given in the United States, so there can be a few extra dollars to be used to reduce unemployment.
Well, we've never been known as a sector, I think, for being that great at collaboration. And that's, again, asking what the public wants. That's what the public wants. They want to see people be able to work together and establish an agenda to move things forward. And it's going to be one of those times we're going to be challenged. We need to do it.
Oh, absolutely. I also write a newspaper column for the Westchester Guardian. And it's about retired people trying to show they're still vital. It's a story column. And one of the things I found out by interviewing retired people constantly is that their last big opportunity, how do they want it to be? They want it to be honest. They want to do it right. And, of course, they want to do it quickly.
Yeah.
And these are great attributes for voters.
Yeah.
What do voters want? They want their politicians, someone to be honest, do things right, and do things quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been talking to them, and I have some retired people calling me and say, should they consider running for election at age 65, 70? And we just had an election in the 9th Congressional District in Brooklyn and Queens where the winner is 70 years old, and the loser
and
is
Republican.
A Republican, and the loser is 55. You expect 15-year difference, and the winner wouldn't be such a quick thinker, so good on his feet, which, of course, are critical critical benefits to the politician. But he won.
Yeah.
So maybe the society is also ready for the older politician. I mention this because we need change, we need change. And all society is saying it. Now we need institutions, whether they represent the retired, whether they represent charities, whether they represent universities, religious groups, to stand up. Hey, we have these ideas.
That can
effectuate
that change. Right. Absolutely. We're speaking to Alan Lux, who is the director of the Center for Nonprofit Leadership at Fordham University, and we're going to continue our conversation with him right after these messages.
When disaster strikes with a vengeance, Americans strike back with generosity. Thanks to your monetary donations, the Salvation Army is there from the very beginning and remains until the healing is complete, serving the physical and emotional needs of disaster victims and emergency responders. Give today at 1-800-SAL-ARMY or SalvationArmyUSA.org and help the Salvation Army continue doing the most good. Where do your donations to the Salvation Army go? Wherever hope is the only thing left. Wherever a life can be turned right side up. Wherever good can overcome. In your community and throughout the world, in unexpected emergencies and in everyday survival, thanks to your contributions, the Salvation Army is doing the most good. Donate today at SalvationArmyUSA.org.
Welcome back. This is Andrew Frederick. You're listening to The Business of Giving on News Talk Radio 710 WOR. We're going to continue our conversation now with Alan Lux. Alan, this is quite an honor. The Big Brothers Big Sisters established the annual Alan Lux Award for Public Policy. And I know through your remarkable career, you've had three extraordinary pieces of public policy that were passed, two when you were over at the Alcoholism Council and one with Big Brothers Big Sisters. But why don't you tell us about the first two while you were over at the Alcoholism Council, what they were, and a little bit about the dynamics of how does somebody such as yourself have an idea and then turn it into law.
Before I take credit, I want to credit the society around us, because I teach about public policy change in the Graduate School of Fordham. After I went to Georgetown Law School, I went into the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And people said, why'd you go in the Peace Corps? Because I wanted to. But society was saying that. It was the Kennedy era. Kennedy had been assassinated, and Lyndon Johnson was president, the war on poverty, and society said, do it, mm-hmm. do it. So I had the Peace Corps, then I came out, and I practiced law in Harlem, and then I went with the Rand Institute, as you said. I'm saying it's hard now because society isn't saying do it. Society is saying worry about yourself. But so I take credit, and I always tell people when I teach my class, I take credit, but society was saying, Alan, you just can't look at yourself in the mirror. You got to look at the big picture. You got to look at the world. But that's how you feel better about yourself. So I'm the head of the Alcoholism Council, and a woman comes to me, and she says, you know, I don't understand something about becoming a cop in New York City. I said, why don't you understand? She said, my husband is a recovered alcoholic, and they took away his gun while he was getting treatment, and they put him on what they call the Bow and Arrow Squad. I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I apply to become a cop, and they reject me. Doesn't make sense. So I called up the Department of Personnel in New York City, the police department, and they said, that's right, and it makes sense to us because we don't want people who drink carrying guns. I said, I understand, but what about our husband who's a cop, and you're going to give him his gun back after he finishes treatment? He said, it may not make sense to you, but it makes sense to us. So after all, it didn't make sense to me, and then I began to realize there were a lot of people who recovered from alcoholism could be very good cops. And there was a governor at that time of Iowa, Harold Hughes, who's a recovered alcoholic, and I was talking with him. He said, this is insane.
Yeah.
A lot of times people say life is insane. We talked before, and you don't do anything about it. But I looked in the mirror, and the society was saying you got to do something about it. So I looked in the mirror, got involved with a lawsuit against the city. We won.
Okay.
They threatened to cut off the funding to my agency. But we won, and then the law was passed. Once they lost the lawsuit, they had to pass the law. The law was passed that says that you couldn't discriminate in all kinds of employment mm-hmm. against a recovered alcoholic. That would lead to my second law.
Yep.
Because Ed Koch is now mayor, and Koch hires a man named David J. Sensor to be the health commissioner of New York City. Now, Sensor is an internationally known health commissioner. And he gets trouble getting approval by the city council. The trouble being, he's a recovered alcoholic. But ho-ho, we had the law that was passed, that we brought the law up, and Sensor now became health commissioner, one of the greatest health commissioners New York City ever had. And I was doing some research then, and we're getting more and more research on what they call FAS, or the fetal alcohol syndrome, that women who drank a lot, more than two drinks a day, were at greater risk of giving birth to a baby with birth defects. So we were talking about it, and then the director of the alcoholism program in New York for New York State, Dr. Sheila Bloom, also a wonderful person, said we should do something. It's insane that there's no warning about it. And we did a study at Metropolitan Hospital, primarily lower income mothers, and 85% did not know about this danger, and no one was telling them. Excuse me, Denver. So we decided to marshal everybody, and we had from the Junior League to the Children's Aid Society to all the hospitals. We all got together, and we said this is going to be easy. easy. First lesson is nothing is easy in public policy. And we introduced a law into the city council saying, the warning post was saying, drinking alcoholic beverages during pregnancy can cause birth defects. That law was supposed to, if successful, put warning posters up in bars, liquor stores, and also supermarkets. And you won't see them in supermarkets because supermarkets had a better lobbyist against us.
Right. And but they weren't going to be on the bottles themselves, though.
No, eventually they became.
Right,
no,
but not at the time.
Not at that time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden the lobbyists came and they attacked. The lobbyists for the distilled spirits group, the lobbyists for the beer manufacturers, the lobbyists for the wine industry. Today, they say the greatest thing that ever happened to them was that law, because now people couldn't sue them because if they gave birth to a child with, unfortunately, a birth defect. But at that time, they were against us.
Yeah.
But after a long, long fight, and Ed Koch signed the bill, city council approved the bill, and that law, which is if people in New York will go into a bar or a liquor store will see it, saying warning drinking alcohol beverages during pregnancy, has had a significant effect. The Gallup poll showed a 22% increase in awareness when the law was passed, and that law has become a national model, as has the anti-discrimination law. And so that when anyone picks up an alcoholic beverage, beer, wine, distilled spirits, you'll see on the bottle a warning. This could be a warning about drinking during pregnancy, now also a warning about driving while drinking. So that's good. I mean, you ask me why
that's
do you
great.
You feel good about yourself. You've changed the world a little.
Sure.
My kids, you know, all the people, many people I've helped at Big Brothers and the Alcoholism Council and other agencies. I help many people. But I look at my kids and I say, hey, when they go into a restaurant.
That's your dad.
That's my dad.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, the poster could be dirty and filthy and scribbled on, but that's my dad.
And one thing they don't appreciate either is that something like that today, which just seems so common sense and self-evident, it was tough. It was revolutionary back then to get that piece of legislation passed. And there really were many obstacles along the way that you really had to push. Well, what's the key to get something like that? Is it knowing the right people, or is it just dogged persistence?
It's dogged persistence.
Mm-hmm.
Public policy is having an issue you believe in, that it's honestly, is that it's not going to help you, it's just going to help the people who need the help. And you have to devote time. You get close. Mm-hmm. You think the mayor's going to sign the bill, and all of a sudden I would get a call on this one from the opponent set up a phony union, and the union said, we deliver beer. And you're going to scare beer drinkers. And since beer drinkers are going to be scared, they won't buy beer, and we're going to have less beer to deliver, and therefore we as blue-collar workers are going to lose our job.
Yeah.
That's insane, of course. Mm-hmm. It sounds crazy. But politicians don't like conflict.
Right.
They don't like problems. So when they heard it, they said, hey, Alan, we have to hold up on the bill. And then the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States, the representative, called me and said, Alan, we were thinking of giving your agency $100,000, which at that time was a huge amount of money, $100,000 grant. But now we don't know if we can do it if you pursue this law. So you got to keep on pursuing it. But if you're honest, it'll work.
Yep.
I believe that but you have to have the time, and it's very difficult. It's very difficult especially for today's agencies, as we mentioned before, who are so worried about their money, to take time out. No one's reimbursing for you this. I didn't do it all extra time, and your coalition of people are helping you all on their own to really bring up this coalition. But when it happens, well, let's put it this way. That is the basis of democracy. Yeah. That's how this society works.
I'm going to fast forward for a minute, and now you're the executive director of Big Brothers Big Sisters, which I think is the largest mentoring organization in the United States. But there was one big missing piece in that whole mentoring equation, and you enacted a law to be sure that that was covered.
Yeah,
what was that?
And that was more insanity. Mentoring works because the big brother or big sister gets close to the girl or boy that they're helping, and they bond. They also can sleep over. They can sleep over someone's house.
Mm-hmm.
They can go on hikes together. And what you're always worried about, the rare times, and God forbid, is a case of abuse. And so we all had a cases of abuse in the newspaper, and we would talk about different mentoring agencies. He said, this is insane. But like I said before, no one does anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we started this law, a proposal to New York State to require criminal background checks. Now, who could be against it? Whenever you do public policy, the first thing you have to realize, someone will be against it. Here, some small agencies, in fairness to them, said, if you do require criminal background checks, we can't afford it. We said, you shouldn't be doing mentoring if you don't do the big criminal background checks. So our law said to New York State, you must pay for the criminal background checks. But not having these criminal background checks is wrong. It's wrong for the people of New York City. And we're talking about New York State, and we were talking about probably $150,000. Between $150,000 to $300,000 New York State would have had to pay. And this went on and on and on. And finally, George Pataki, the then governor, was approaching the end of his reign. And I said, oh, my God, I'm going to have to go to a new governor.
Start all over again.
They offered us a deal. And the deal was, we're not going to pay for the criminal background checks, but we'll require, it's called the Safe Mentoring Act, we'll require organizations to tell the parents, do we even do criminal background checks? And if a parent hears this organization doesn't do criminal background checks on its mentor,
they've been so warned.
They can go somewhere else. And that's not what we wanted,
but
you settle. So often public policy, you have to settle. But at some time, we should bring back that law to require criminal background checks, because periodically kids get abused.
If there was one piece of public policy legislation you'd like to see passed today, what would it be?
Well, couple of pieces. I wrote a book called The Healing Power of Doing Good, based upon research that showed that people who help others have significant health benefits, but in kids who do it, they have significant boost in self-esteem. Washington, D.C. school system has used it in poor schools to get kids, because it's hard to be handsome or beautiful or a good dresser or wealthy, a great student, but anyone can be a good volunteer.
Yeah.
And so kids who weren't doing well in school, they would make them volunteers and make them help kids who were slightly younger than them. And they had a nice change in the improvement in academic achievement. So I tried with the New York City school system a couple of times, so far unsuccessfully, to require community service. A lot of parochial schools have it, private schools have it. But for the million kids in the New York City public school system, and everyone doing one-on-one helping of someone else, you can have a force out there, a force to help the kids, a force to help the city, and a force to show exactly what we're doing with the problem we have right now in our country, this polarization. People don't help each other. And that could be a model for other major cities across the country, not just Washington, D.C. and New York. They say people helping. That's the basis of our society. So that's one law I'd like to get. A second law, not so much a law, but a second movement I would like to get is I'd like to get nonprofit agencies. I would hope nonprofit agencies in different cities would band together and say that as long as there's this polarization in society, as long as we're having this terrible unemployment of between 14 to 25 million, the charitable field are going to keep our voice raised for both Republicans and Democrats, that you must talk to each other. You must stop this polarization. We must help this society. Our bonds, our United States bonds, were lowered in their value. And what was the biggest reason Standard & Poor's said? Because we don't get together.
Right.
If you have a worse problem after the chance of default back last August, if you have a worse problem, we don't know if you, the government, can cooperate.
Well, there's no question about that. I don't think it was a problem itself. I think it was people witnessing to say, wow, I don't know if these people can solve their problems. And then when it comes along again, there's no sense of assurance that they'll pull it out.
I mean, and you can't solve problems unless you talk to each other.
That's right.
You got to talk to each other.
And give a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Charities represent that. So my second wish would be that to somehow, and I've been trying, is to somehow make charities a needed force in this country to rally the country during the recession. By the way, I'm not making up stuff out of the wind. During the Depression, we had what we call the community chests. And the community chests were a tremendous force, not just to provide food for the unemployed, but to be a source of saying, we need to have social change. We need that now.
Absolutely. Yeah, as far as the Center for Nonprofit Leadership at Fordham University, if anybody was interested in learning more about that program, what would they do?
They would go to Fordham, fordham.edu/nonprofits, nonprofits, fordham.edu/nonprofits. And there's a whole website there. Tell us about when the next courses are. We have next courses, in fact, coming up in November. And if they want to do it, just download the application, send it in, and you'll get a certificate if you have to attend the courses and participate. But you'll get a certificate issued by the Graduate School of Business, the Graduate School of Social Service, and hopefully the skills and knowledge you need and really support for the rest of your career to make the kind of nonprofit leadership programs and nonprofits, charities in New York, in the metropolitan area, that can change society.
And it's remarkably affordable. I can't thank you enough, Alan Lux, for coming in here today. It was great having you.